Today is Friday, July 15th, 2011. This is Jack Crawford at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm interviewing Olympic 10,000-meter runner Van Nelson over the phone today in order to record his experiences and reflections of the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. All right, so we're here with Van Nelson, and you were a 10,000-meter runner in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yep. I ran the 10,000 meters at about 6.2 miles.
Nice. And can we begin with a little bit of background information, like where were you born?
I was born here in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1945, and lived here all my life, went to school here in the Twin City area, and then later on went to St. Cloud State College, which is in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and then I became a graduate there, and then I went on to graduate school at the University of Minnesota after that. Obtained my master's degree in the mid-1970s.
All right. And so you grew up in the area?
Yes, I did, and I still live in the area as well.
And what was your early athletic or sporting experiences?
Well, I started running cross-country when I was in the 11th grade, a junior in high school. And then I quickly advanced through the ranks of track and field and cross country at the high school level. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I had run the fifth fastest high school mile in the United States at that time, back in 1964. And then I went on from there and continued to improve until I finally made the Olympic team.
Excellent. So what were you doing? You were living in Minnesota while you were training prior to the Olympic Games?
Well, yeah. I was going to college at that time and was training up in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And then we had some high-altitude preparation. At least we made an attempt at it. And I spent, right before the Olympic Games, I spent 3.5 months training in altitude at South Lake Tahoe in California. And we had a little Olympic training camp up there on the mountaintop. It was about, 7,500 feet.
7,500 feet? Is that about equivalent of what it was in Mexico City?
Yeah. It was probably just a tad higher, but it was equivalent to what Mexico City was. Not all athletes on the U.S. team trained at Tahoe. Some of them were at other facilities in the United States. It varied depending on where they were training. But most of them in track and field were up in South Lake Tahoe.
Right. Do you feel that the training at that location adequately prepared you for the Olympic Games?
Well, we were up at Echo Summit, which was at the top of the pass. And I feel that it did do us some good. And I'll tell you what the situation was, especially for distance runners. I don't think it affected too much the sprinters or the hurdlers and those people, but it did help to some extent the distance runners. And it was different than Mexico outside of the altitude. Mexico City was hot and humid, but at approximately the same altitude. And that made a lot of difference to me. Some runners, it didn't, but to me, it made a lot of difference because I'm used to coming from being in Minnesota, the upper Midwest, where the weather most of the year is cool and dry. And when I went into humidity and heat, it just didn't sit too well with me. I ran very well in the Olympic trials in Echo Summit, but it just wasn't the same when I got to Mexico City with that altitude and plus the humidity and heat. I had run in the World Games in the year before in Tokyo, Japan, and had a hard time, got second there, but I had a hard time, even though that was sea level, it was very hot and very humid. And for me, it just didn't sit very well.
Right.
Does that help you out there?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay. But that was for me. Now, other runners, you know, distance runners and athletes came from hot, humid conditions. But for me, it was very tough going into that. I did very well. I thought I was going to do very well in the Olympics. But it just took it right out of me when I was in that environment.
Right. So you felt strong going in.
Oh, yes, I felt extremely strong. I figured I was going to probably place in the top six, but I finally wound up in the finals of the 10,000 in 28th place.
Excellent. I was reading up on you and in your pre-Olympic experience, you started off at Southwest.
No, I went to Washburn High School.
Okay, Washburn.
Yeah, went to Washburn High School. They changed the boundary lines. My younger brother, Richard, went to Southwest High School, but I went to Washburn.
Oh, okay. Because I look like you stated once that a major early influence on you was Al Haley.
Yes, Al Haley was a coach at Southwest High School, and Al Haley has won more high school championships across country and track and field than any other high school coach. He has passed away now, but he was he'd always train his athletes about two blocks away at Lake Harriet. I lived close to a big lake, Lake Harriet, and every day I would say and see Al Haley with his runners down there, and they were the very, very best in the state, very best. And I always admired him and his team, and we had a good friendship going as well, you know, even though I was on the opposing team. When we went to the conference and city and district and state championships, I was basically in cross country the only runner that would upset his clean sweep. And same in track and field when I ran the mile. Nothing was over a mile when I was running in high school. The mile was as long as you went.
Right, so is that primarily what you competed in, was the mile and the cross country?
Correct. Yep. And back then, my best time in the cross country, which was only a mile and I think it was 1.8 miles, and we'd run that, and that was quick. I'd run that in 8 minutes and about 36 seconds. And
wow.
That was cross country. That was really moving back then.
Yeah.
And then in high school, I ran a 4:17 mile.
That's pretty quick.
That was, well, they're pretty quick nowadays, but back then that was really burning up the turf outside of Tim Ryan, you know.
Yeah.
That was good enough, and I had come across the information somewhere, I can't remember now, but that was good enough, that 4:17 mile, to place me fifth in all the high school runners in the United States. in the mile.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was going okay.
Yeah. And so I understand that you ran 2 a days most every day for your training?
When I was in high school, yes, I would run 2 a day workouts. I'd do it on Saturdays and Sundays. And then I would also try and do it 2 to 3 times in the morning before I went to school in high school. And the reason I started doing that was because of Al Halley's influence. He would always be down there with his athletes, down on the track or Southwest or down at Lake Harriet doing their distance runs early in the morning. And I always figured, if I'm going to beat these guys, I better be doing what they're doing. So I was running 2 day workout most of the time in high school, especially my senior year.
Wow, that's a pretty hefty workout.
And then I'd run all through the summer, too. When school was out, Al Halley had what we call, he had a 1,000-mile club. And that means if you put in 1,000 miles during the summer, from the time, I think it was like from June 1st to, you know, when school started to Labor Day, you got this special shirt. Well, I never got a special shirt, but I was going to put in 1,000 miles just like his runners did. And not many of them got that 1,000 mile. You know, they'd fall short, maybe 900, 800 miles. They'd still put in the mileage, but that 1,000-mile club was kind of special, and I kind of did that all on my own just to see if I could be as good as they could be.
Right. And then you went to St. Cloud State.
I went to St. Cloud State College, correct, up in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
And the coach there was, what was his name?
The coach there was named Bob Tracy. And he was one of the Olympic assistant coaches in track and field in South Lake Tahoe. He did not move on to the final games in Mexico City because he had his obligations to teach at St. Cloud State. He was a professor there. And so the Olympics were in October, and he had to be back to work in September.
So he didn't get to go?
He did not get to go as one of the assistant coaches to Mexico City, but he was one of the assistant coaches up in South Lake Tahoe.
Would you say he was a big influence on you in college?
Oh, yes, yeah. Very much so. Very, very encouraging. He saw to it that as I advanced, that I was getting invitations to these special meets, you know, like the Melrose Games, and, you know, I was flying all over California, New York, down south, Canada, Toronto, Winnipeg. I was going all over the place, you know, and Bob and I would fly together. He was like a second father to me.
Yeah.
So not only did we participate in the school meet, but Bob also went with me most of the time to these meets in the summertime and during the school year.
Can you tell me a little more about your relationship with Bob Tracy? It sounded like it was pretty close.
Oh, yeah, very, very close. And then after I graduated, he moved. After he got his doctorate degree at the University of Minnesota, he moved and was head track coach at the University of Hawaii. And I was out there several times to visit him and his family. And then he had some heart problems. He moved back to the United States, and he almost died a number of years ago. And my gosh, you know, the family calls me right away, and I just fly right out there, you know. And then, about 3 years ago, Bob died of cancer. And I flew out there and visited with him just a couple weeks before he died. So, yes, I was very close to him. Very, very, very close. And we traveled a lot together, and Bob was very well respected in the United States in the time, but he had to do some other things. This is when he was working on his PhD at the University of Minnesota right after the Olympics in 1968. He was a candidate for the United States Olympic Committee, and there's not many of those guys around.
Yeah.
So he was very well thought of, very well thought of, very knowledgeable, not only in distance running, but all of the activities, the triple jump, the long jump, you know, the hurdles, just all of it, you know.
That's great. Did you have any close relations with any of your teammates on the 1968 team?
Yes, I did. One of them should have been on the team, and for some reason there was a glitch and he didn't make it. That was Dave Patrick from Villanova, and I remained close to him. And Tracy Smith, who ran the 10,000 with me, and Jim Ryan, and we've kind of drifted apart, you know.
Yeah.
I was pretty good with Ralph Boston, the long jumper, and some of the other ones. Stan Wright, who was one of the assistant coaches from Texas, who was on the U.S. Track team there. And Ron Dawes, who was from my Minnesota Twin City area. He was on the marathon on the 68th team. He's passed away. And Willie Davenport, I was pretty close to him for a while there because we were in the NAIA together. We were not in the NC2A. So, you know, there was a couple of guys there that now and then we communicate. And Ron Laird, I talked with him a number of times over the years by phone. And we also had an Olympic reunion 4 years ago, basically, you know, or 3 years ago. And it was a nice time to renew acquaintances with a lot of the guys that did show up at the reunion.
Yeah. Do you recall an event? I guess it was instigated by the Harvard crew team. They issued a formal statement of sympathy for black athletes. Did you ever get that letter?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. And I wasn't aware that they made a statement on that. I was in favor of the black movement, you know, by Lee Evans, John Carlos, and Tommy Smith, and empathized with them. But I believe that the Olympics should be politically free. And I just think it was, you know, I go along with their ideas and what they stood for and things they wanted to get across. But I kind of have the feeling myself that it was the wrong venue to demonstrate with the black fist salute. Now, I'm not against that salute, you know, but I think it was the wrong venue to do it, because I think the Olympics should be politically free from political movement.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear anything about what Smith and Carlos had planned prior to them doing it?
No, I did. It was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
It was a surprise to me.
Were any of the other athletes talking about it that you remember?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. Afterwards they talked about it, but
yeah.
Before that I didn't run across too many people that I knew of this was coming. Didn't know that.
So what kind of things were they saying after it happened?
I left the Olympics a little bit early. So I didn't stay all the way to the end, and I flew back to South Lake, well, California, and went to South Lake Tahoe because I had my car there, and I had to pick up my car and drive back to Minnesota before winter hit, and I had to travel through the mountains, and I didn't want to get caught in a snowstorm, so I left a little bit early. I didn't stay till the end, And so I don't know too much about what was said after they did that.
Yeah. So you did not stay for the closing ceremony?
No, I did not. No.
Did you attend the opening ceremony?
I did not. The three 10,000-meter runners did not attend the opening ceremonies. And the reason being that you were on your feet for hours and hours and hours, and the very next day, back then, the very next day was the 10,000-meter run.
Uh-huh.
So we figured, and the coaches agreed, that that would be too much stress on us to be standing out there for hours and hours and hours when we had to run 10,000 meters the next day.
Yeah.
But we watched it on TV.
Well, what did you think about that?
About what?
The opening ceremony, what you saw.
Oh, very nice, very nice. I wish they would have had, for me, and I would have liked to have been in it. I wish they would have had the 10,000-meter run, you know, several days down the road, you know.
Right.
Because I really wanted to be on the opening ceremonies, you know. But we were there for a reason, and that was to put forth our best effort and do the best job we could. And with those kinds of physical stresses on us of opening ceremonies, you've watched opening ceremonies before, I think.
Yeah.
They're very, very, very long, and there's no place to sit down.
Yeah. A lot of standing. So how were the accommodations when you were in Mexico City?
Well, in my opinion, okay, the accommodations were poor. The food and the cafeteria were excellent. I mean, they were outstanding in their ability to put on the table what you wanted anytime you wanted. But the accommodations were like in high-rises, as I recall. It's been a number of years now. And we walked in there, and they didn't feel very good. They were cold, cool and damp and humid. No air conditioning that I remember. And there were concrete floors and concrete block walls and concrete ceilings. No paint on them. Floor, ceiling, walls. It was like living in a cold, humid basement. And then there would be a light hanging in the center of the room with a light bulb on it, on the wire. And there'd be one light. There'd be about, there was kind of a suite, as I recall. There was like four to six of us in one bedroom on beds. And then there was you'd walk through and there was a shower area. And then there was about four to six athletes. That was in my accommodation now, on the other side of the bathroom. And it was too pleasant, you know. I've been in a lot of places and a lot of accommodations, and I'd have to say that those were, in my opinion, the places I've been, the worst I've ever been in. And the accommodations for training, to go out on a training run, were very poor. I tried to get to the practice field, and the bus drivers wouldn't be on time. It took us me, and there was other athletes, 2 hours bus ride to get to the training facility, you know, and the other training track, and it was just poor as far as living accommodations and training accommodation. And I couldn't run in the streets because you get your leg chewed off by dogs, you know. And as a distance runner, I was used to just, you know, going off on a 10-mile run, maybe around the lakes or up the river or through the woods, you know. But it was not a very friendly feeling running through the streets. I tried it once through the streets of Mexico City. I kind of was fearful for my own protection. So, but the food was great. The food was great in the Olympic Village. And they cooked meals that we were used to, you know, and that was great.
So how do you feel security at the Olympic Village was?
Well, we had passes to get in and out. I think for me, the security was okay. I mean, it was great. You know, we didn't have a lot of people in our Olympic Village that shouldn't have been there. You know, they all had passes on. So I didn't feel threatened by any sort of adverse group that was going to come in and do us harm. Felt pretty good staying there as far as security was concerned.
Did you hear anything about the student massacre?
Yeah, I heard a little bit about that. Though security was probably tighter at that time than it had ever been previously.
So they didn't. It didn't seem to affect the athletes very much.
Not in my opinion. It didn't seem to affect the athlete and myself for the United States.
Yeah.
Seemed to be pretty secure.
So the games also happened at the height of the Cold War. Did you happen to meet any of the athletes from the Soviet bloc?
No, I didn't. I did not engage with them on any social type of plane at all.
Were you trying to avoid them, or just didn't have a chance to cross?
No, I didn't avoid anybody. I just went about my business, and whomever I ran into, but no, I didn't try to avoid them at all. I don't, maybe some of the other athletes might have, but they didn't say anything,
1968 was also the beginning of the testing for banned, performance-enhancing substances.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember getting tested?
They didn't test me. They must have been selective on who they were testing. But I never got tested to the best of my knowledge. Never took any blood samples, never took any urine samples. But no, I was never tested. I feel that, they should test everybody. They should test everybody because it's just not right to win or even go to the Olympics if you have to cheat.
Was there, did you notice any of the media, reporters were hanging around the athletes, were they bugging you, or did?
No one ever, bothered me when I was there, and, I didn't pay too much attention to it, I was a pretty young kid, I was about 23 years old, and, didn't pay much attention to the media, unless they approached me. But outside of that, I was just kind of going about my daily business, and trying to get my training runs in and my, eating and the other things I had to carry on to do, at the Olympic Games.
Right. Trying to run through Mexico City.
Yeah. Tried it once, didn't feel very good, so that was the end of that. So I had to relegate myself to 2-hour bus rides, and the buses sometimes wouldn't pick you up. And one time I remember I was at the training field, and the bus driver didn't come, and it was about I was away from my dormitory room in the shower for about 4 hours. It was just horrible. Horrible. You'd finish your workout and you'd sit around for a couple hours waiting to be picked up and transported back to the Olympic Village.
Did you see any local impact of the games in Mexico City?
No, I didn't. Nope, I did not. But for me, I was pretty well sheltered in the Olympic Village.
excuse me. So, if you could give a piece of advice to today's Olympic hopefuls, what would that be?
Well, here's what I'd have to say about that. There's no shortcuts to success. You got to win honestly, without cheating, when without the use of drugs or blood doping. Otherwise, it's a false victory to even make the team, in my opinion. And you're only cheating yourself and your country when you do such things as, you know, using drugs or any other enhancing performance techniques. So win honestly, work hard. There's no shortcuts. And you just got to put in the time, and that's why you compete. To see if you're better than the next guy, hopefully that is doing honest things as well.
Very good. What do you think of the amateurism versus professional athletes?
Well, in my opinion, I think the 1968 athletes were the last of the non-paid-to-run team. You know, they might have gotten a little perk here and there, you know, $50 or something, you know. But basically, the bulk of us did it just for the love of the sport and self-integrity, and we all had school we were attending or jobs we were attending. It isn't like today where they have Olympic training camps, and they put you up, and they feed you, and house you for nothing. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But we were the last, I think, of the last non-paid athlete. You know, you're on sports teams now. You're carried on sports teams. Probably the biggest perk I ever got was free Adidas track shoes. You know, because I was on the U.S. team in the summertime, and I was on the Olympic team, and the guy, the representative, Dick Banks, would make sure that, you know, because I went through shoes like every 2 months, you know, training 20 miles a day. My training flats would be just all worn out every 2 months, you know, and being in college, you know, I couldn't afford to have, you know, new shoes every 2 months. I was watching my budget, you know, so we basically did it, like I said, just for the love of the sport and self-integrity and just had a good time and a good feeling doing it.
Nice. So in your opinion, what was the most meaningful part of the 1968 games?
What was the most meaningful part?
Yeah.
Well, I would say going to the Olympics was the most meaningful part to me. You know, making the Olympic team, there was only about 46 of us on the team, athletes. Well, you know, there's other sports, but in track and field, male track and field, there's approximately 46 of us. And that's pretty slim pickings. There's not many guys on the team, you know, because we're entitled to one back then. And then you had to have more. You had to qualify. You had to meet the qualifying times, all of you. So just being on the Olympic team and just going there was a thrill for me. I'd been on the Pan American Games team, and I'd been on the World team. But, you know, the pinnacle was to make that Olympic team. And I did that. And once you're an Olympian, you're always an Olympian. No one can ever take that away from you.
Very true. So, what do you think of this? What does the preservation of the 1968 U.S. team legacy mean to you?
Oh, it means a lot. Because I said, all of us basically were the last of the, primarily the last of the non-drug-enhanced teams. and one of the very last non-paid teams. You know, they're little perks like shoes, maybe $50 or something, but outside of that, you know, we were the last of the last. We were the last, in my opinion, in the preservation of them, the last team that, you know, did it just for the love, just for the pure love of the sport. After that, it got, you know, it started to get more political, and the Russians not going, the United States not going, and, you know, blood doping, and, oh, geez, just, you know, all kinds of stuff, and trying to beat the game, you know, and, trying to beat the drug testing stuff. I knew of one athlete, and I'm not going to mention his name, he's dead now, but I knew of one athlete that was using steroids, and that was the only one I knew of on the U.S. team.
Did he perform well? Do you think it aided
his... I can't remember how he performed. I'd have to look him up, but he didn't place in the top three, I know that. Matter of fact, I was his roommate for a while up in the trailers up in Echo Summit, and he had Roy's rage. This guy was nuts. I very quickly told the coaches up there, I said, I can't be this guy's roommate. I got out of that situation. The guy would come in at night, he'd be ranting and raving and throwing lamps around. You know, there was a bedroom on one end of the trailer and a bedroom on the other end, and I had one, he had the other. And he'd come in ranting and raving at night, you know, and oh, man. He was one of the weight guys, you know. He was about 200 and I'd have to say 70 pounds, and there was little old me at 135 pounds. I was no match for this guy.
Is there anything else you think is important that you'd like to tell us?
Well, no. Just about it, you know, unless you had any more questions. I don't know if that was helpful to you or not.
Oh, you were very helpful. Very helpful. It was a great interview. And we'll go ahead and turn off the recorder.
Okay.
This has been an interview with Van Nelson. And we're speaking to you from where?
Speaking to me, with me, from South St. Paul, Minnesota.
South St. Paul.
Yep, I'm in South St. Paul, Minnesota now, which is the suburb of the Twin City area.